Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 87, Planes, Trains, and Automatons. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWiL. Hello, and welcome to This Week in Law, episode 87, recording on November 19th, 2010. We've got a great show for you today. Joining us today for the first time on TWiL, but hopefully not the last, is Lisa Barakin from TechZulu Law. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Denise. Thanks a lot for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. I've really been enjoying your show, which kicked off in October and is another technology law podcast. So if you guys like TWiL, definitely go find Lisa over at TechZulu Law, right?
That's right. It's at techzulu.com.
Wonderful. And of course, lisabarakin.com is Lisa's own site. Lisa's a lawyer and writer and commentator for LAist and a really fun person. So great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I've been listening and watching for a long time, and I'm a big fan of Leo's network.
Thanks. Also joining us today is Venkat Balasubramani. Hi, Venkat.
Hi, Denise.
Great to have
How
you back
you?
On the show. I'm doing really well. Great to hear you and great to have you back on the show. We've been going through some jumping through hoops with Skype this morning and unfortunately wasn't able to get Venkat's video, but we've got him and that's the most important thing. So Venkat, of course, is also a lawyer, and he blogs over at Eric Goldman's blog, does guest posts there, and has his own blog, Spam Notes, and is a great Twitterer, too. So thanks for coming on with us today, Venkat.
Thanks, Denise.
My pleasure. And Evan Brown is with us again from Hinshaw & Culbertson in Chicago. Hello, Evan.
Well, hello, Denise. How's it going?
It's going great. Really good to see you and to have you back on the show.
Yes, the same.
We were just saying we've got a long list of stuff to cover today. I hope we managed to get through at least some of it. What I'd like to start out with, since it's been kind of on my mind lately, so I like to just get these things off my chest, is the planes aspect of the planes, trains, and automobiles links in our show. The whole snafu that's going down right now and the backlash online and from the flying public about the new airport scanners and the new security procedures and a couple of legal aspects of those procedures. So if you haven't been following along with this, and I'm actually both surprised at the volume of the outcry against what's going on and also at how many people on the other end of the spectrum seem to be kind of oblivious that any of this is going on, just, you know, on my own anecdotal taking the pulse of people I've talked to, I'm seeing both those things. So for anybody who's not aware, the TSA has rolled out some new procedures where there are going to be two different kinds of advanced imaging technology scanners at airports. There's something like 68 of them at airports in the U.S. now, and they're looking to expand that quite a bit and get all the airports covered with one or both kinds of these scanners. One of them uses X-ray technology that has people and doctors up in arms about leaving radiation signatures, you know, that are cumulative and build up over time and never go away and certainly can't do you any good on the getting of cancer front. So those things are going in. And if you opt out of them, there's going to be a more aggressive, and this rolled out last week. Anybody who listened to TWiT got to hear Odakta describe them going down into his sweatpants and doing his TSA pat-down experience, which is a much more invasive process than it used to be. So folks are feeling like they're not very good options either way. And on the legal side, down in Florida, hat tip to Gizmodo for publicizing this. One of these scanners, not the X-ray type, but the microwave type, which is not supposed to be as great a health threat, is in place at a federal courthouse. And Gizmodo got hold of, through a Freedom of Information Act request, several hundred photos of people going through the scanner. And the kicker about that is copies aren't even supposed to be made of those images. They're not supposed to be saved. They're not supposed to be leakable because of the obvious privacy concerns. So what we've got coming from Florida is, you know, a bunch of civil servants going into work and going through their scanner at the federal courthouse. And now their body images all over the internet. So not so great for them. Evan, what do you think about having federal courthouse employees showing their virtually naked body scans online against their will?
Well, I mean, obviously there's some real problems with that from a real fundamental privacy standpoint. And at the basic level, it really seems to be a breach of trust here. The propaganda that we've gotten from the government all along on this is that these won't be saved and that they won't be shared and that they, you know, won't even exist, so that they might even be leaked or somehow the security of where they're stored is being compromised here. So, you know, there's no question that this is an outrage, that these would be made available. You know, we're clearly on a path that something's got to give here. You know, this particular situation in Florida that Gizmodo broke, in and of itself, is not all that bad. It's just more of an indication of things to come, because these, you said they were microwave images, you know,
millimeter or something. I'm not quite sure what the actual.
However, they're made, the resolution is really low. You can't, you know, it just looks like something you'd see on Ghost Hunters or something like that. You can't really see, you know, a whole lot of resolution and detail into, you know, the people's anatomy like you can on the back with the backscatter technology. So, I mean, this particular Florida situation is not all that egregious, but, you know, we can just see where this trend is going to go. If these are available, you know, and not being destroyed as what the public has been promised, then it's, you know, only going to be essentially certain that the more high resolution images will be you know, made available. So it's just a really huge invasion of privacy. And I think that there may be some interesting constitutional questions about it that I'm not quite certain how to articulate, but it would seem to fall under some kind of due process analysis. Oh, that's great, what we're seeing on the screen.
Thanks for that work.
That's a great image.
I'm glad I've already eaten lunch.
And you can see what they had for lunch, too.
Pretty much. Right. Yeah. So I think as far as where this could go on a legal, at a very broad sense, there's got to be some kind of constitutional due process issue going on here.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way. And folks in the IRC are saying, you know, TSA to American public, won't you just all please fly naked? Because that would make our job so much easier. So yeah. Maybe we'll move towards, at least in the warmer climes, a more nudist-friendly environment in the United States. You know, my biggest concern, I personally feel like it's already such a violation of your privacy and personal space as you're going through the scanners, even with the metal detectors. You know, you've already got your shoes off. If you've got a big coat, you've got to take that off. You've got all this stuff coming with you in big plastic bins. It's just a nightmare anyway. Yeah. That, you know, getting a little bit more of a touchy-feely pat down doesn't bother me all that much. You know, it's just incrementally slightly worse than it already is, which is a sad statement. But when you start to throw the children of the nation into the scenario and the young adults of the nation, that does kind of make me more uncomfortable. The TSA has come out with a statement that those 12 and under are going to be subject to a modified kind of a pat down if they opt out of the scanners. But nobody knows exactly what the details of that are yet. I posted over at the TSA blog a comment asking for some clarification, but you know, it's buried in 175 other comments to that post. So who knows? Hopefully they will iron that out for us, because I'd certainly like to know that before bringing my kid to
the... Yeah, this is just government surveillance run amok. I think the basic constitutional law principles should give us some guidance in how to think about this, because generally you're free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And most privacy jurisprudence begins from what is your ordinary and reasonable expectation of privacy. And as Web7239 is pointing out in the chat room, some of these images are things that you could never release as part of a medical record. So, I mean, this is just really extreme.
Yeah, we need HIPAA to start governing the rest of the government. That would be wonderful. Venkat, any thoughts on this?
Well, I don't want to lose whatever little libertarian credentials I had, but I do think it's not obvious that it's unconstitutional to force people to choose between an intrusive pat down and a scan. And I think you've identified a lot of the problematic aspects of the scan, that, you know, whether it's implemented appropriately, the medical issues. But what was interesting to me was just to see the internet backlash and how the TSA's feet are really being held to the fire. And I think one follow-up point as well is that I think profiling is obviously one alternative. And when you kind of look at the choice between profiling and everyone having to go through some kind of intrusive scan or a search, all of a sudden the search, at least for the people who might get profiled, looks like, hey, this isn't such a bad alternative. I mean, I'm definitely sympathetic in presenting the contrarian perspective here, but I don't know that I was as disgruntled as what I've read out there.
Well, isn't it kind of ironic that you'd have to get a search warrant, I think, to use this kind of extraordinary technology if you're going to do a search of somebody's property? But for your person, there doesn't seem to be the same level of government check.
Well, I'm definitely not a constitutional expert, but I think at border crossings, the standard is well accepted that I think the standard is somewhat lower. And I think there's been disputes around laptop searches. And I think it raises a whole host of issues, but this is much different from somebody searching your car or somebody searching your house. And I think the legal view is, hey, if you're going to travel, you're going to have to sacrifice some of your privacy. And I think the standard is somewhat lower. I'm not saying that the standard is satisfied here, but I think that's the argument at least.
And that's really where the important discussion is to be had. I'm not sure there's a meaningful distinction to be made in the looking at this question of reasonableness from whether it's a person's you know, house or their effects or their person. What is really most probably the most troubling aspect of this analysis, or I don't want to say troubling, but the most relevant aspect of this analysis is this question of consent. I don't think there's much of a question that it would be a Fourth Amendment violation for us all to be subject to these searches or, you know, this kind of surveillance, this kind of imaging, if when we're sitting in our homes minding our own business. Let's at least, you know, answer an easy question.
Yeah,
that would be a, you know, a clear Fourth Amendment violation. But there is then this the question then becomes, where do we draw the line of the reasonableness here when the necessary condition that must be met in order to travel is that one submits to these very invasive searches. There's a we have a constitutional right to travel in this country, just like we have a constitutional right to privacy. And the best way that I can articulate this constitutional question, which, you know, still remains nebulous even after, you know, my best efforts at trying this, is that, you know, is it so invasive and such a unsavory to the ordinary sensibilities of a person that we are, in effect, denied this constitutional right to travel, because without doing this, we cannot do that. We cannot travel. It's unreasonable to think that somebody, as an alternative to air travel, would drive their car from L.A. to New York for a business meeting or to take the Amtrak or whatever. So there comes a point when the magnitude of all of this stuff balanced against one another, I believe, should yield a net result of unreasonableness on all of these fronts.
Yeah, I put a poll up on ZDNet on this topic and asked people, you know, are you gonna go through the scanners? Are you gonna opt for the pat down? Or are you just not gonna fly anymore? And 80% about said they're not gonna fly anymore. And I, you know, who knows if that's just the backlash of reaction against this as it rolls out, or you know, a serious threat to the entire air travel industry. And
yeah, I'm kind of surprised that the airline lobby hasn't really taken a position on this. And I wonder, I don't know that I've seen a clear articulation of the government's legitimate interest and why they suddenly seem to need to escalate the degree of search that people must go through. Was there a particular event that triggered this, or is it just that there's fancy new technology that the TSA is eager to try?
That's a good question.
Go ahead, Venkat.
I was just going to throw in an anecdote and say my parents went to India recently, and my dad had this crazy idea of bringing a printer with him. I don't know why he did that, but I was like, pointed out that, you know, bringing a printer in light of, you know, somebody that the printer cartridge that was mailed from somewhere would probably raise a few eyebrows. He went ahead and did it anyway, but it was kind of a funny anecdote.
It is. My impression is that, or what I had heard is more than my impression, was that this increase in scrutiny was in response to the attempted Christmas Day bombing. Was it Detroit? Last year with the underwear bomber.
The underwear bomber.
Really what's precipitated all of this.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we're already having to bring tiny bits of liquid with us, if any. So there's that threat that was out there, that has been out there since 06. So I guess this is their current response. And of course, there are all kinds of conspiracy theories out there about, you know, who's making all the money off these many hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of scanner equipment being put in, and what's the real agenda here?
I think this is a battle worth fighting and following up on, because personally, I think the underwear bomber is so anomalous to what is the usual threat you're trying to guard against. I think that it's overly paternalistic to make every single air traveler walk through this device just to guard against the off chance there's going to be another underwear bomber. I mean, if people are really that concerned about it, they have other options. They can, you know, try to travel in different ways. But I don't think that it justifies putting everyone through this horrible constraint on freedom of travel.
And the way I like to address that point is, you know, not to say that security is unimportant, because that's absolutely not true. But what I prefer doing is to look at what, you know, smart people like Bruce Schneier are saying about this. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the leading, you know, expert on security matters, and he tends to point to data that suggest that this type of invasive search is not nearly as effective as what resources committed to intelligence would be in getting more of a profile on the individual on an informational level. Now, that's certainly not without its problems and its privacy implications, but it's just not as gross, if you know what I mean. Both in the nasty kind of level, but also just in the corporeal kind of nature of all of this. And Virgil in the chat room, you know, loyal listener, you know, put up a link, and I didn't click through, but, you know, this is something that I hadn't thought about before. But the link that he put up suggested that the article he was linking to was talking about the TSA agents' response to having these new responsibilities. They, you know, they surely cannot be enjoying it. It's not like they're all, you know, getting off on this stuff. It would have to be
pretty rotten.
Yeah.
Well, I think I think this is a great example of how we need to think about our constitutional rights and whether we're willing to tolerate something that's now enabled through technology that we would never in a million years suffer if it were being done sort of in meat space. I mean, can you imagine a full body cavity search? People would never accept that. But there's a long tradition of somehow treating actions that are taken, whether it's by the government or private entities, if they're done through a new technological means, people just don't seem to be that sure on how to react to that. And I think it's great to bring it back down to fundamental constitutional principles.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. So I'm sure that we'll see some lawsuits if we haven't already. I think one of the privacy groups has already challenged the scanners. So we will see what happens there. But I'm kind of interested too in whether the public reaction will be enough that we see large scale protests such as on November 24th, this coming Wednesday. It's supposed to be opt out day when people, you know, are going through the airports for their Thanksgiving holiday, are urged to choose the opt-out option, which will slow things to a grinding halt if lots and lots of people do it. Things are slow enough for travel that day anyway. It sort of reminds me of the other story we saw last week with the fellow who had the unfortunate, and it should certainly intended as simply frustrated and humorous and not a legitimate threat, the tweet about blowing up the airport because he was late. And the reaction to that, the I Am Spartacus hashtag reaction, where, you know, people were tweeting out exactly what he did, or, you know, encouraging or just daring anyone to come prosecute them. Of course, the guy got hit with a big fine. That's going to be paid for him. So, you know, I mean, it's sort of a song and dance of going through and slapping him on the wrist and saying, hey, you know, you just can't go threatening to blow up airports. Well, probably thousands of other people have made the same threat now, maybe hundreds of thousands on Twitter in the wake of that. And I'm wondering, in response to all these new heightened security methods and the bad choices we have about going to the airport, what sort of public reaction is going to happen and how people are going to be punished for that, what the TSA actually has authority to do. There was an episode with a guy in San Diego who, you know, I don't have all the details on it. I've read some of the coverage, who attempted to opt out of screening altogether. And again, over on the TSA blog, they've clarified that if you get there and you're going through the line and you don't know beforehand that you're going to have to make this bad choice and you decide, hey, I don't want to be screened and I don't want to be aggressively pat down, so I'm out of here. You know, I'm going to go get my car out of the parking garage and drive wherever I'm going. And apparently if you do that, the TSA has the discretion to levy a civil penalty of up to $11,000. But each case is determined on the individual circumstances of the situation. So, you know, they do have rather a big stick to hold over people. Again, you know, that seems even more constitutionally suspect to me. Evan, any thoughts?
I've heard the rationale for that is they don't want terrorists to be able to do trial runs, you know, to mm-hmm. try to figure out what the security is going to be like. So that's, I don't know how to resolve that. And, you know, it also seems like a good, you know, with that discretion that they're given, it seems like a good opportunity for maybe racial profiling or some kind of other type of unlawful or, you know, whatever profiling, or, you know, the exact opposite of that, letting people off the hook who might otherwise fit the profile of those who have committed terrorism before, you know, being more lenient towards them, you know, trying to avoid the appearance of singling them out based on some kind of, you know, ostensibly protected issue. So I don't know how to resolve that.
It just seems to me, you know, to mix my transportation metaphors here, it seems to me like this is a speeding freight train out of control on the way to a collision for the TSA, because at some point they're going to have to make that decision with a parent, you know, a very sympathetic kind of a person to portray in the media who has gotten there, is surprised, has their children getting pat down, objects and wants out. And, you know, they're not going to like having to deal with the media and public backlash of that situation. So,
well, we're still talking about the Robin Hood Twitter conviction, first of all, I think it's kind of funny, sorry, to the extent there's humor in the story, that it occurred at an airport called Robin Hood, and that Stephen Fry is the one who's going to pay the £3,500 fine. It's interesting that this story happened because a couple of weeks ago I saw a question on Twitter that asked, what is the internet equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater, which is the metaphor that we all know from the Schenck versus United States case that is used as the example of when does a government interest sort of trump the right to free speech. And I do agree that there is a concern about starting down a slippery slope, but to take the government's point of view, I mean, it's difficult. This is a classic problem of not being able to really filter out ironic statements on the internet, which is an age-old source of confusion and misunderstanding. It's just difficult, I think, because most of us, I think, who are veteran travelers know that they don't really have a sense of humor. They really can't. So I think this raises a difficult but legitimate problem. I think it's a lot more understandable than the TSA scanners, at least in my opinion.
Well, I want to get to talking about what's going to happen when we all go into our electronically, automatically driven cars as a result of being scared away from the airport. But before that, I'd like to thank one of our sponsors for today's show, Squarespace. Squarespace is a wonderful service that provides both hosting and design services for your website, blog, any sort of web presence that you need to have. It's the fast and easy way to publish a really high quality website or blog. And it has so many wonderful features, I can't even tell you. I've had my blog Bag and Baggage over there for more than a year now. It's super easy to use. Its UI is really intuitive, makes it very easy to work with if you're someone who's not very comfortable with HTML, CSS, all the rest of the web design stuff. And if you are one of those experts, it makes it very easy for you to use too, because it gives you all the flexibility you want to be able to customize things just how you like. For those of us who are not quite that proficient, it's got modules. It's just kind of drag and drop. You can add a blog, you can add a forum, you can add forms, all your Flickr photos easily integrated, Twitter, the rest of the social media services all get brought in really seamlessly, Google Maps and more. There's website tracking and a built-in capability of doing everything you need to know, everything your site needs to be doing for Google to find you and your search results to do what they need to do. There's permission access handling. It's really, really fast and stable. I've never had my site go down, and it's always really snappy and responsive. There's an iPhone app that comes in very, very handy for both tweaking things and adding photos, whatever you might need to do on the go. And you can use this to update just about anywhere. And there's a free trial. You don't even need a credit card. You just go, try it out. You can import your material from wherever else you might have it, be it on Blogger or WordPress or whatever. Give it a try. Then if you decide to purchase, use the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, and you'll get 10% off the lifetime of your new account, which is really, really reasonable. So go ahead and check out squarespace.com. And thank you so much, Squarespace, for sponsoring our show. So, Evan, you and I love to talk about robots on the show and artificial intelligence. And, of course, Google has been busy testing its automatically driven cars. And this is something I've been wanting to get into on the show that we haven't touched on yet. The legal aspects, the legal ramifications of having cars drive around without human controllers. And over at the New York Times, John Markoff pointed out that there are a whole raft of legal issues there. In California, senior staff counsel for the Department of Motor Vehicles has actually said that he thinks what Google's doing, testing the cars, is legal under the California motor vehicles laws because they are all capable of being brought back under the control of a human driver, and there's a human driver in the car as they're testing things out. But you can readily start to see how if we begin to cede over the responsibilities that we've all traditionally had as drivers, the liability questions start to get really interesting to consider. So, Lisa, what do you think? Are you ready to jump into a car that, you know, we'll let you maybe do your show in the back seat while it's driving you up the 405?
Absolutely. Anyone who deals with all the texting drivers in Los Angeles probably thinks this is a great idea. I think that it's actually a wonderful application of technology. You know, there are legal issues because it's not what we're used to. I would think that very strict product liability would apply. But to answer your question, absolutely, I would try it.
Yep. Venkat, I'm not sure. Are you in Santa Clara, close to where?
I'm in Seattle, actually.
You're in Seattle. Okay. So you haven't actually seen these things driving around, I take it.
I haven't, but I think I share Lisa's enthusiasm. Seattle definitely has a lot of traffic, and the prospect of being able to sit there and you know, surf the web or do something while your car drives definitely sounds interesting to me as well.
Right. But there are some thorny legal issues, as John Markoff has put it. Evan, what do you think? Is our whole product liability system equipped to deal with automatically driven cars?
It might be if there weren't this real driving... sorry, I really shouldn't have said that. If there weren't this like really strong impulse among automobile owners to modify their cars, to pimp their rides, if you will, because the issue then becomes, how do you assign liability to the original manufacturer of the automobile itself or the autonomous guiding system if there's an accident? You know, if you hit somebody or if you're involved in some kind of accident that could be attributed to the failure of the mechanism, and discussing the issue in that way is can be used as a segue into a recent paper that Ryan Kalo, our friend who's appeared on Twill a couple of times before, just wrote, that'll be forthcoming in the Maryland Law Review, that talks about this kind of intermediate, or actually he calls it selective immunity for these manufacturers of autonomous technologies for modifications, for you know, harm that can come about because of the modifications that people will make on the autonomous machinery in the aftermarket. So that seems to be where a really ripe area of legal you know, machinations could go about on all of this, because it would be pretty clear that you might be able to apply traditional product liability doctrines if people were just going to drive their cars and you know, they never needed to be interfered with, their if they didn't need to be maintained and have new parts put on them, or if people didn't want to modify them the way that they work from their stock condition. That's where
right,
I see.
Right, and I don't think it even needs to be as extreme as people who really want to seriously get in and modify and pimp out and tweak their cars. You know, we can't even go on airplanes with our cell phones on for fear of screwing up the electronics. So, you know, who knows? Something quite minor could be an intervening cause of an accident in an automatically driven car. What do you think, Ben Cat?
Evan raises a good point as well. That leads to something else, which is I don't think Google would be very happy with somebody modifying the car or the software that runs it, and I could see a battle around, you know, the hacking or the modifications, and whether people are allowed to do that and what kind of steps the companies take to prevent that.
That's right. Maybe we need an Apple car where, you know, it's very locked down and there's an app store, as opposed to an Android car where, you know, it's open source and you can tweak and add things from a liability standpoint.
A completely closed operating system that can't be modified.
Yeah.
Good point.
Lisa, I think you're going to have to introduce us to your dog.
Her name's Zoe. She doesn't have a law degree, but she just turned 13, so she was actually able to get a Google, Gmail, and Twitter account.
Oh, perfect. Yes, she's of age. Wonderful. So as long as we're talking about Google, I've got a couple of other things in here that were interesting. Google has added to Google Docs the ability to sync up with its image search capability and insert and publish images from Google Image Search, which is nice and convenient, and I'm sure people will love it. But I really, really wish they had done something to incorporate their Creative Commons search, because if you're going to just, you know, streamline the process of ripping an image out of Google Image Search without addressing the copyright implications of that, you're going to be handing people a bunch of headaches that they maybe don't even know they're taking on. Venkat, have you looked at this, and what do you think?
Well, I think that's a great point, and it raises another issue, which is if it's that easy to rip and I don't do anything to select any images and include them in the document, can I get by with saying, hey, I'm not really infringing, this is no different than a Google search, which Google has robust protections around.
Right.
So I haven't really played with it much. I mean, I'm just a very basic Google Docs user. And one thing I saw is that I think there were some points people raised that, you know, how to do footnotes. And it didn't seem as intuitive as, I mean, Word is not very intuitive in my opinion either. But I'm not a big user, but I think there's a lot of interesting applications, as you point out.
Evan, do you think that this sort of, it's not that they're inducing people to infringe, but I just feel like there should be a warning label involved. What do you think?
Well, you are from California, so we can look past that. At a certain level, it's no different than just providing somebody with a web browser that allows you to right-click on any old image you come across and save that to the clipboard and put it in a Word document. This just maybe shortens the distance between point A and point B, you know, to allow that to happen. But, all kidding aside, not to pick on you in your California sensibilities with the warning label, I mean, I think it's worthwhile to, you know, for people to be cognizant of the fact that even though it may be easier to infringe and certainly not as easy as what we might like to find appropriately licensed content, you know, it'd be nice to work in a Creative Commons search on there. It's still worth knowing about and having a more pronounced sense of what appropriate reuse of images are.
Well, and my point, Denise, was that could I just put a DMCA notice on the bottom of my document and say, hey, I didn't come up with these images? I mean, what you were saying was that you could search. I don't know if the user actually has to search and find the images or if there's an automated way to just stick some images in a document. And that's what I was getting at, which is if the user's not jumping through a bunch of hoops, can they say this is just third-party content? And if you want to take it down, you know, send a DMCA notice. I don't know if that's far-fetched, but that was what I was getting at.
Probably good advice. That means, you know, everybody who's occasionally publishing a document from Google Docs would need to have their DMCA registered agent notice on file and all that stuff. I can't see people really doing that. But it's an interesting point.
There's still the argument that you could make, even if the content as it's appearing in the document is, inline linked, I guess, was to another server, I think there would still be the argument that the work as a whole, the selection and arrangement of all of it, might be a new work that is a derivative work because it incorporates some of these other things. So the DMCA may or may not help you if you could still be considered a direct infringer by using this functionality, bringing in images and content from around the web. That's the kind of wrinkle I would see on that whole analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as the legal liability for Google's creating new tools that would seem to make it easier to potentially infringe copyright, I think that the analysis of previous case law, like Google versus Goddard or Goddard versus Google, would probably put Google in a fairly safe place if the technology itself is fairly agnostic and neutral. I don't really think that they step into a clear territory of encouraging infringement.
Right. I don't think they've got great lawyers over there at Google, and they're well familiar with the Grokster decision and what the standards are for inducing infringement in this country. So, you know, I'm not really thinking that Google would have liability, but, you know, who knows? It could be.
You know, what's interesting, though, is that if the still photographers or artists who make two-dimensional images were anywhere near as well-funded with their lobbyists as motion pictures, I think this could start to go in a different direction.
Right. And, you know, I mean, every now and then you get one that is quite protective about their images, and that's how we wound up with the... oh gosh, now I'm blanking on the name.
Shepherd Fairey?
The older Ninth Circuit case that basically blessed using thumbnail images. Kelly versus Arribasoft, yeah. So that was just one photographer who got ticked off and sued that resulted in that decision. So let's talk too about Hoogles. Evan, why don't you tell us what that is?
Hoogles is a very entertaining little blog that has screenshots from Google searches, you know, with the instant feature, with all the, you know, how the little suggestions come down from the search window, the search field when you're trying to find something. And let me bring it up here because there's just some really funny examples. It's Hoogles, Hoogles.com. And, you know, it begs the question or makes you ask, who Googled that? And so we were, before the show actually started, we were talking about some of these little, you know, some of the funnier ones on here. I pointed out there's an entry from November 15th that has a screenshot from Hoogles. Where apparently, if you go to Google and just start searching for pickles are, one of the suggestions you will get is pickles are destroying my life. So... This is a real glimpse into the psyche of some people. What would make somebody search for that is quite entertaining to think about. Just lots of really interesting views into people. So I also liked, can blind people see the taste of Cinnamon Toast Crunch? You know, it's easy for us to sit and poke fun of that, but we all spend some time thinking about synesthesia and all of that stuff. So I can see Cinnamon Toast Crunch, and I'm not blind. So yeah, Hoogles is a great site.
Yeah, I love it just, you know, for playing around with, but I threw it in for our discussion today because I don't think, you know, people know when they're doing their searching in Googles that Google's collecting all this information anonymously, and maybe they know about Google Zeitgeist and the trends that people are able to go and see, but what they might not think about is something like Hoogles that some wacky search that they've done is going to be pulled out and available for public view and ridicule. And, you know, if there's a privacy ramification there, even though that all of this is anonymized, of course, people have been able to take anonymized data and put together exactly who it is that put that data out on the web without too much trouble. Venkat, do you think Google Instant Search has some privacy concerns involved?
I think it does, but from what I, and I think the points you highlighted, but from what I know, my impression was that Google anonymizes and people seemed okay with that. I mean, I think it just raises the issue of, you know, who gets their hands on it, and is there some database somewhere that where somebody from Google or elsewhere has access to it? But so far, of the categories of data that has been abused, I don't know that that search queries are up there. Although I did come across somebody, and I don't have the link in front of me right now, that pointed out that I think police officers in the context of a criminal case used a Google search to kind of piece together what was thinking. And I don't know the details of the case, but I think that you definitely raise a good point, is that there are privacy concerns in what you search. And there's also another site called Autocomplete Me. I don't know if that's the same thing. It's kind of a humorous look at Google searches, but it uses the Google Autocomplete feature. I don't know if any of you have come across that one, and I don't know if that's the same kind of concept as Google's, but that's also a humorous take on Google queries.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's using the same data, which of course has been out there for a while. You know, my Firefox toolbar has been doing it for long before you actually got it in the Google search interface itself. But it's just, you know, it is an interesting window into what searches have been done around whatever it is you're going online to look at.
Yeah, it's great. I just went to Google and I typed in "I like to," and at the bottom of it, the last. I mean, most of them are normal. Like, I like to move it. I like to move it lyrics. You know, we all are big fans of Madagascar too. But at the bottom is "I like to tape my fingers together."
You do?
Well. Sure, I guess somebody out there. So, great
and stuff. And because someone entered that into Google, they're clearly looking for a kindred spirit.
So there's a matchmaking aspect of this. This re-identification could be a good thing for the public interest.
Absolutely. Well, Evan, let's see. Let's talk about something else that you sent me during the week. From your neck of the woods in Chicago. This doctor who, now Burke, I don't know, you probably shouldn't put some of these pictures up because they're icky, but there was this plastic surgeon in Chicago who got some, it sounded like, you know, possibly well-deservedly bad reviews on Yelp for his work, because the news story that you sent along, Evan, had some photos of work that had been done on these patients that complained, and in any event, instead of just lying down and taking the bad reviews and trying to, you know, respond to them in a more professionally beneficial way, I guess, the doctor decided to come after some of the Yelp users. So what do you think, Evan? Tell us more about this.
Yeah, I'm actually involved in this litigation. I represent one of the John Doe, he's not a defendant, but one of the targets of a subpoena. And that's why I made a cameo appearance in this this piece that was on our local news this past Monday. And so, I mean, this is just a really good demonstration, I believe, on what we talk about so much on this show, the Streisand effect of negative commentary, of somebody being the target of criticism or the target of some kind of language that person does not like about them online, going to the courts, using the law in a way that is that appears to be calculated to simply unmask a speaker for the sake of unmasking them, to embarrass them and harass them, just, you know, having that as an end in and of itself, rather than the real intent to seek redress for defamation. So that using the law in circumstances like this, where it's not appropriate to be using the law in this way because of the weakness of any underlying defamation claim, or you know, in this the circumstance that I'm involved in, and I'm not saying anything that I shouldn't be talking about, because these are all in filings that are a matter of public record, going after somebody who where the cause of action for defamation has long passed. That's not a reason. You know, you shouldn't be going after somebody and risking violating their First Amendment interest to speak anonymously in circumstances like that. It's very clear in those types of situations that there's no legitimate reason to be using compulsory process of a subpoena to identify someone that way. So I was, of course, pleased. My client was very pleased to see this on the news because it is drawing attention to this conduct that we disagree with, and it's definitely a good example of the Streisand effect.
Venkat, where do we stand on people's ability, like the plaintiff in this lawsuit, the doctor, to actually get at the identity of people who have posted with sites like Yelp or a blog comment? Or it seems to me like we're all over the map and that courts just sort of on a case-by-case basis decide whether a subpoena or a court order is an appropriate thing to do to unmask one of these people. And it seems to me like there's a lot of leeway too for the actual service providers to say, you know, we're going to take a policy of, okay, if you subpoena us, we're just going to turn over the data. Or no, we're going to really make you jump through hoops and show relevance and good cause and all that. Is there any kind of guidance we can give people on this?
Well, I think courts have, there's probably three different tests that my recollection and, you know, at one extreme, I think some courts say, okay, if there's a colorable case, you can unmask the commenter. And then at the other extreme, some courts say, you know, you have to satisfy almost a motion to dismiss or even a summary judgment type standard to unmask a commenter and really hold the feet to the fire of the person who's trying to unmask the commenter. So I think it varies, but by and large, my impression is most jurisdictions require some sort of showing. I mean, you can't just go to court, show a statement of opinion and say, okay, I want to find out who said this. But I think you raise another good point, which is a lot of this depends on the policy of the intermediary, and some intermediaries take the position that we're not going to give up anybody's names and we're going to fight. Some intermediaries may notify the person who left the anonymous commentary and let them find a lawyer. In this case, Evan's obviously involved. And so I think there's a lot of little tweaks that affect whether somebody can be unmasked online. But nowadays, it seems like the internet is a very effective force in exposing these disputes. And, you know, a ton of disputes come along where I would imagine the lawyer thinks, hey, I'm going to file a lawsuit and issue a subpoena. But lo and behold, you know, Evan's involved or the EFF's involved. And next thing you know, there's a newspaper report and Streisand effect and the whole thing kind of backfires. So I think the standards are somewhat mixed, but by and large, most courts require some sort of showing. And one follow-up point I was just curious about, which is I would be very curious to see the data from companies like Yelp or just in general to see what types of people and what professions sue most often to try to get rid of these bad reviews. Dentists, for some reason, you always hear about cases involving dentists suing Yelp reviewers, and in some cases Yelp unsuccessfully. And I think Professor Goldman posted something about a Yelp case involving a dentist recently. So I'm always curious to see who are the types of people and what professions are most often asserting these defamation claims. And I would be curious to see some kind of data on that.
I'm thinking dentists, restaurants, hotels, and the TSA.
Veterinarians. There's a big class action by the Dog and Cat Hospital that's pending in San Francisco. But I think that the idea and tradition of anonymity on the internet is going to continue to be a very contentious issue. I think that you guys were talking with Jack Lerner last week about the Social Media Bill of Rights, and that's a very sharp divide as to whether that's a fundamental right to be able to speak anonymously. And when you get into a situation where you have somebody's profession and livelihood directly affected by an anonymous commenter, if there are factual statements, of course, we have defamation law, and we also have countervailing First Amendment jurisprudence that sort of guide to what degree you can say something. Of course, opinion is very well protected, but you know, these are difficult cases, and when you throw into the mix the internet culture, it'll be very important to see where it goes.
Yeah, Lisa, tell us more about the social network users Bill of Rights, and where folks can go to contribute to that, and what's going on with it, what its impact will be.
Well, we're hoping that it will provide, you know, some sort of numerosity to articulate what users want, or even just to fire start the discussion of what our rights and expectations should be. You can learn more about it at cfp.org, and we're in the process of putting together a website where people can cast votes cumulatively on the different line items and also have a discussion. And I'll be sure to send you that link. Yeah, we're just getting the ball rolling.
Is it your vision to present this to the various big providers such as Facebook, or just to have it out there and gain traction through word of mouth?
I think both. I think that the idea was, as Jack mentioned last week, that there were a lot of assumptions that were being claimed as far as what users want, what users expect. And there were large numbers of users who were trying to say, no, that's not what we want at all. Don't do it for us. Mm-hmm. So we just wanted to tabulate one place where people who had strong feelings about this one way or the other can kind of get together and just demonstrate some sort of proof of concept.
Great. Well, thank you for undertaking that effort. I hope that our listeners and viewers will definitely go check it out, because certainly there's a lot to talk about there.
And thank you so much for shining a little bit of attention on it.
Oh, sure. Our pleasure. It's an important thing. So I want to take one more break here and thank another sponsor. But after that, you guys get to drive. I put way too many links in our discussion points. So each of you think about one more thing you want to toss out for us to discuss. And then we'll wrap up with our tip of the week and resource of the week. But in the meantime, I want to thank our sponsor, MailRoute, at MailRoute.net. And I want to let you know that MailRoute is a service for people who have their own servers. So if you're a business, you know, a small or a mid-sized business, say between 1 and 1,000 users, Lisa, you're a solo attorney, so am I, this would be a good fit for us. Anybody who isn't just a casual webmail user, but has their own domain and their own email that they need to use, you know, lawyers for security purposes. I've been in lots and lots of discussions with people lately about the desirability of storing email in the cloud and how to make sure that that's sufficiently secure and that your clients have given their consent to that kind of thing. So if you're being cautious and having your own mail server that you host yourself, MailRoute is a great service for you because it provides protection for that mail that you're hosting. It is spam filtering and email spoofing. So what it does is it will give you a backup when your server is down so that senders don't see email bounces. It also has an optional outbound email service. And it's a very, very, very excellent spam filter. So if you're not anxious to give up the good spam filtering that you have when you're using a service like Gmail or another cloud-based service that has it all built in, if you add MailRoute to your internal server that you're maintaining, it will give you that really nice fine-grained spam filtering. And, you know, as lawyers, this is near and dear to our hearts, because we actually might need to see emails that sound a lot like they're a 419 scam, but actually maybe they're a client who needs to transfer us money to be held in trust, et cetera. So we need our spam filters to actually be able to recognize those kinds of fine-grained differences. And MailRoute is a great service for making sure that that's possible. So it's a wonderful thing to think about. If you have your own server, go check it out at mailroute.net, and you'll get 10% off the lifetime of your account, which is a great deal. It's a great add-on for email services for professionals and small to mid-sized businesses, and we thank them so much for their support of This Week in Law. So Venkat, give us a story from our list that you think we should touch on before we wrap up here.
I like the, this one has been beaten to death, but I like the CookSource copyright controversy. And you had posted the Mass Live, the link from Mass Live, that CookSource was ceasing publication. And the quick background to the story is that a blogger noticed that one of her stories was being used in a print magazine, and she had had no dealings with this magazine called PrintSource. And actually, one of her friends told her, "Hey, you know, I didn't realize you were submitting your blog entries to CookSource." And she emailed the editor of CookSource and said, "What's going on here?" And the editor sent back a snide response that was like, "Hey, we're performing editing services for you. You should be thankful." And all the blogger wanted was an apology and I think a donation to some cooking school or something like that. And her blog entry got picked up and gained steam. And next thing you know, CookSource was like the bete noir of the internet. And there was a Facebook page, and it just really spiraled out of control. And the story you highlighted basically said that they're ceasing publication due to various issues.
Yeah, so, it's a good object lesson. You know, if you're a jerk, don't count on being able to be a jerk in public. And if you're going to really, really misunderstand copyright laws, that can qualify as being a jerk. And it looks like this has actually managed to be the nail in the coffin of a magazine that probably was having troubles anyway. Evan, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to jump on the bandwagon and get mad at CookSource, but there's a part of me that feels really sorry for this lady, having been the target of all of this abuse and backlash on all of this. So, you know, despite the fact that she woefully misunderstood copyright and some of the social norms of how content is used and shared on the web, it's sad to see her go out of business over all of this. So it's almost like nobody wins.
Yep, I agree. Lisa, any thoughts?
Oh, I think this is kind of a sad story, too. I really enjoyed the discussion that Tom Merritt had about this story in Tech News Today a couple weeks ago. But I just think that, you know, people need to learn. They just can't get away with shenanigans. You know, it's going to come out. That's one of the things the internet does. And, you know, while I'm sorry to see a recipe site go out of business, you know, I just picture this woman from New England thinking, oh, it's going to blow over. And it just really didn't. So, you know, it is, as you said, a great object lesson in how times have changed.
Right. I mean, we started out the show talking about Big Brother, the government, but this is Big Brother, all of us, right? You can't make a pretty bad misstep anymore without there potentially being an online backlash against you if it's, you know, bad enough that you're able to incite people's ire and sympathies.
Just be glad 4chan didn't get a hold of it. The worst thing that happened is she stopped publicating the blog. And, you know, count your blessings.
Absolutely. Okay, Evan, what should we hit before we wrap up today?
Well, I wrote a blog post this morning thinking about fire sheep and black sheep. This is this is kind of so last week, perhaps, but I was reading about the, you know, what Black Sheep does, and just, you know, thumbnail sketch here. Fire Sheep, of course, is the Firefox plugin that allows you essentially to be able to access other people's social media content. It, you know, kind of looks into the cookies on the browser, somebody else on an open or on a public Wi-Fi network. Black Sheep is another Firefox plugin that counteracts what Fire Sheep does. And so I was reading about that, you know, that TechCrunch article from last week about this. And one, the line that caught my attention was a description of Black Sheep saying that the way that it works is by leveraging Fire Sheep's code. And I don't know what that means. I put up a tweet last night asking for some help, and I've gotten some useful responses back. I still haven't nailed down the question if when Black Sheep leverages Fire Sheep's code, if what it is doing is making a copy of that code, or at least a part of that code. And so that got me thinking, you know, in copyright terms, which, you know, we haven't, I don't think, discussed this in terms of a copyright issue, because one really hasn't been apparent. So what are Fire Sheep's rights against the use of people using Black Sheep? One might say that, well, Black Sheep, all Black Sheep does is, you know, provide this tool, and it's the users who do this infringement. But if Black Sheep is doing this, knowing that this leveraging this, and if that is a copying of Fire Sheep's code is going to occur, does that not bring it within the purview of potential contributory liability under a Grokster analysis? So I had an interesting email exchange with my dad about all this, and as I was writing back to him, it got me to think that the way that we're analyzing this problem sounds an awful lot like some of St. Thomas Aquinas's writings in the Summa Theologica. So I spent a little bit this morning hammering out a blog post that takes the format of an entry from St. Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologica evaluating this this issue. So that's what I've been, that's what I was thinking about on my commute this morning, Fire Sheep, and Black Sheep, and copyright, and Grokster.
And for all of you playing the game at home, you can now drink, now that we've referred to St. Thomas Aquinas on
the show. Evan
Brown. And the Summa Theologica.
Right.
Well, that we'll give our tip of the week early then, because Black Sheep was what I was going to mention as the tip of the week. The as TechCrunch describes it, the only available solution that attempts to pit Fire Sheep against itself, leveraging, quote-unquote, much of the Fire Sheep code, detects when a session is being hijacked and alerts the user. So interesting copyright twist there, Evan. But for folks who don't want to be Fire Sheeped on any open networks that they may be using, at their own risk, of course, Black Sheep is the solution for you. Lisa, any thoughts on this one?
Oh, on Black Sheep? Well, I'm reminded of the adage in privacy law circles that security through obscurity is no security at all. And I thought that it was incredible that from what I read, Fire Sheep takes advantage of a fairly simple privacy flaw that would be easy to fix, but people just seem to be fairly unaware or apathetic about it. I'm really not that concerned about Black Sheep sort of infringing some rights that Fire Sheep might have in its proprietary code, as much as I am about just the fact that, you know, who do you trust? You know, Black Sheep claims to block Fire Sheep, but, you know, who's going to watch out for what Black Sheep might need in terms of your data to install it? Whoever wants to figure out that puzzle, you know, I salute them, because I think that the massive amount of private data that's shared on social networks is definitely cause for concern.
All right. And Lisa, one last story from you for us to chew over.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We have got to talk about COICA, Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act. That was a shock to me that Act came back like a bad penny right after the elections. And it's close to my heart, because all my career, I've practiced both in entertainment and internet law, and I've done domain name arbitrations from the very beginning. Just for people who aren't familiar with this, this is a proposed bill that would essentially allow the U.S. government to seize domain names that are used to host websites that not just enable infringement, but provide access to known pirates. And this just opens a whole host of legal issues, First Amendment rights. And I mean, there's
right,
a lot
the whole
to
thing,
talk about.
The whole thing turns on the fact that the big domain name registrars are located physically in the U.S.
Right. I mean, we see actually more and more domain name, top level domain names ending in .ly or, you know, from other countries. But generally, I think people tend to prize the .com top level domain name. But yeah, this to me, I think their heart is in the right place, that they want to build respect for copyright. And I'm sympathetic to that. But this is basically going right to the top. And, you know, I mean, it's so disproportional to, I think, the threat that someone is going to point or help a website that encourages piracy. You take away their domain name, they have to start all over from scratch. I mean, it's nuclear. I kind of doubt that it would withstand judicial challenge. But we'll see really who is vested enough. I would think that the fact that there's a robust secondary market in the trade of domain names would demonstrate that it's very important to our economy to have some stability in that, at least. And this would just turn everything upside down.
Right. Venkat, you wanted to talk about this in relation to botnets. Well, tie that up for me.
I agree with Lisa, definitely. I think no love from me for COICA. Just overall sounds like a bad idea. It's like it's not directed at pieces of content, and it just I think it's going to cause a lot of problems, and it may not withstand challenge, as Lisa pointed out. The botnet angle is, I just wanted to point out that Microsoft has been undertaking some creative efforts to combat the botnet issue. And in the Eastern District of Virginia, I think a month ago, it obtained a default judgment against a bunch of domain names or a bunch of people that were running these websites that the botnets were operating around. And interestingly, the court said, you know, these domain names can be transferred to Microsoft, which is kind of an odd result. And it just raised a little bit of an eyebrow for me. I mean, mm-hmm. I think botnet is obviously different from copyright infringement, but it's kind of a similar tactic that Microsoft used.
Yeah, that is fascinating. War by domain transfer.
Oh, it's becoming more and more prevalent. Mm-hmm. People are going after domain names because it's a shortcut, an end run, and a de facto takedown. I think there was a case recently where there was a website that published copyrighted song lyrics, and as part of a contempt sanction, they actually took away the domain name and awarded it to the plaintiff. But this is becoming more and more common. And what's interesting in the mix is that I think some domain name registrars like GoDaddy are tending to be more risk averse, and they will just disable or, you know, do something about the website just based on a threat that it will become involved in litigation.
And Evan raised this issue a while back in relation to Righthaven. I think Righthaven, who it looks like it's litigation strategy. This is the newspaper, Save the Newspaper Industry copyright troll. It looks like their litigation strategy is either slowing down or maybe they're taking a second look. But Evan had a blog post a couple of weeks ago that in addition to seeking damages for copyright infringement, they actually wanted control of a domain name of somebody they claimed was infringing. So you're right. I think it's an increasingly used tactic.
Yeah, and in that situation, that to me seems really unconscionable. almost Rule 11 territory. Rule 11 is the rule of civil procedure that, it said simply, prohibits lawyers from filing from making claims in lawsuits that are unsubstantiated by a reasonable investigation of the facts and the law. So if you're going to file a copyright lawsuit and ask for a transfer of the domain name as one of your requests for relief, that is just clearly unfounded in my book. And it's the book that I'm looking at is the Copyright Act. There's no, you know, it doesn't provide, you know, that whatsoever, the transfer of a domain name or the forfeiture of a domain name as a remedy. You know, you can forfeit the infringing goods and all that stuff, but that's different than the domain name. So yeah, that really is irksome when I see Righthaven asking for domain names as a remedy for copyright infringement.
Right. So I'm going to give you our resource of the week before we wrap up here. And it's from Tim Malone at Tech Republic. It's a post that's a couple years old, but he did a roundup of the top 10 sites to debunk urban legends, which comes up, of course, in the legal context and beyond for all of us when you're busy working on a project and you get an email that interrupts you and asks you to be outraged about something that isn't actually something that you need to be concerned about at all. You can send people this list. I've got it over there in our discussion points. Rather than read you the long URL, you can go instead to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/87 and see all the things we talked about on the show today, in addition to this resource of the week, 10 sites that debunk urban legends. And Evan, since you've been chatting with your dad, maybe, you know, I know I frequently need to have my parents check things on Snopes when they're busy emailing me. So maybe this will be helpful for people as they head off to their family reunions during the Thanksgiving week next week.
For sure. Yes.
Yes. And during the Thanksgiving week, we are going to do a TWIL, just not on Friday. We're going to do it at a different day, Monday, at a different time, 10 a.m. instead of 11 a.m. Pacific. So join us then. And all of us today say goodbye to all of you, and I say goodbye to our wonderful panel. Lisa, so nice to chat with you. Great to meet you virtually.
Oh, you too. Thank you so much. This has been really a lot of fun, and you guys are all my heroes. I follow you all on Twitter, and I really enjoyed the discussion. Thank you.
We've enjoyed it too. Folks, follow Lisa. She's at Lisa Brodkin on Twitter, and check out her site, lisabrodkin.com, and her great tech law podcast over at TechZulu. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Also, Venkat, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Glad we got everything ironed out and we've been able to both see and hear you. And it's just fabulous chatting with you today.
Thank you all. I enjoyed it.
I'm really enjoying your postings at Professor Goldman's blog. Please keep that up. Where else can folks find you?
On Twitter, I'm at VBalasubramani. That's BalaSubramani. And I actually started using a service called about.me that lets you create a profile. And it's about.me/Balasubramani.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. And Evan, I'm looking forward to chatting with you in just a couple of days.
Yes, that will be good. So in the meantime, have a great weekend. And
yes.
We're off
too.
To the holiday season. Wow.
I know. I can't believe it. So folks, do tune in usually Fridays at 11 Pacific, Monday at 10 Pacific at live.twit.tv, and check out our Facebook page between shows. I always post up stuff there that I'd love to get your input on, facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. And with that, we'll let you start your weekend. Thanks. Take care.